So, last week after I think I had talked on the karma of white supremacy last week, and it's up on the website, you can listen to it, and someone said something. It was actually a good question, but it was something like, you know, I also practice in these other traditions, but here in Buddhism, wow, it's just all about suffering, isn't it? And I was like, I don't know if it is, but I may have been trending dark in the last little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
So, for no good reason, I'm sure, right? But I want to talk a little bit about love tonight, and universal love and tolerance. And it's been a rough week for universal love and tolerance, let me tell you, out there, as you know. The beautiful quote by the Buddha in the Dhammapada, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is hatred healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. There's a few beautiful threads to bring in. We're talking about love in a Buddhist context. The first is that, like many wisdom traditions, the languages that we have reflecting the Buddhist teachings, Pali and Sanskrit primarily, later on Chinese, Tibetan, but I'll speak to the Pali and Sanskrit, is that there are different words for different kinds of love. And the word pema or prema, referring to a kind of sort of what we think of as love, like a personal love. I love my wife, I love my child, I love my friends, I love my family. I remember seeing a bumper sticker sometime 15 years ago. It was kind of early Iraq War. And it said, I love my country, but I think we should start seeing other people. So that one has a second punch that gets you, you know, a couple of seconds after. I like it a lot. There's a kind of love that we can say is personal, and one of its characteristics is that it has what we could call a definite object, right? I love my wife, and it's Sarah. It's not some other person, and it's not the abstract archetype wife, it's this exact person, right? Likewise, with my baby, although I have suddenly apparently turned into a softie who adores all babies, I don't know how that happened, but mine is still, it's exactly him, and the love I have for him is exactly for him in a particular way. So the language and the tradition separates this kind of love that is also part of what we would call romantic love, the main thing that we get all messed up about, really, here. And other kinds of love that are less personal or that have less of a distinct or direct object. And these are what we could call a more like universal love. And there's a few different words for it. The one we use perhaps most often is the word that's often translated either as loving kindness or friendliness, which is metta. And in Sanskrit, it's maitri, friendliness. And metta is the first of a grouping of four qualities. Metta is the kind of home base quality. And it's a kind of feeling state that can be very strong, very filling and warming and beautiful, as much as any, you know, big personalized love could feel, but it tends toward the universal. It tends toward loving beings simply for being beings. It loves good people and bad people alike in its mature qualities. And it can even dispense with the differences between beings entirely and become deep states of concentration or unified awareness, where the object, such as it is love itself, not any particular destination for that love. And that feeling can then be, it can feel like it grows to fill the universe without boundary or limitation. One of my teachers, I was saying hi to him after sitting a month in silence, and I had been, you know, like, just trying to stay with the breath, and he had been doing loving kindness practice, and I came out of it with a kind of, you know, crisp, like okay, I'm doing my work, and he came out of it looking like this, and I was like, hey, how is it? And he said, oh man, it's so nice. And I was like, I want to do what he's been doing. And he said that he had written in his journal at one point. And by the end of the retreat, he'd even forgotten exactly what day it was or what he was talking about. He just wrote, heart like melted butter. Mm-hmm. And I heard that, and I was like, right? So, heart like melted butter. So metta is this quality of love or kindness or friendliness or care that that doesn't hook onto a specific object. And so it's considered to be what's called a divine abode or a heavenly dwelling place. As in, it's a state that you can rest into and you just kind of live there. And it's a kind of heaven realm. And in case you really like that state, if you die while in that concentration state, the texts say you will go to the heaven realm associated with that state. In other words, you'll hang out in that feeling for a long, blissful time. You will eventually die and return to the cycle of things. You are not leaving the cycle of things by landing in that heaven realm, but it sounds mighty nice. A nice break from, you know, other realms. So metta, as this base quality, divine abiding is called, or divine abode. The word is Brahma Vihara, Brahma for God or divine, and Vihara meaning like a hut or a dwelling place, a place you would stop in your journey and spend the night. So you're climbing the craggy mountain of contending with your demons, and there's a warm hut there for the wandering pilgrim. And you go inside, and there's a fire, and there's tea, and there's some oranges that come all the way from China, and you get to drop your burdens and rest. This is a divine abiding. So metta is the first of four of these divine abidings, or Brahma Viharas. And the next two are the qualities that naturally arise when this universal or non-specific care or kindness meets the experiences of either suffering or well-being. When it meets the experiences that are painful or suffering, that natural love or kindness turns into compassion. It's the same quality, but the context is different, right? It gets a little more specific, and it says, oh, there is suffering. Interestingly, we usually think about compassion as something that has a very direct object, right? I have compassion for this exact person's suffering, or these people's suffering in this context, these refugees or immigrants, or these oppressed people, or my friend who's having this particular hard time. But this quality, compassion, the Pali word is karuna, can also spread in a vast and unspecific way, because you know that everything suffers, right? You know that everyone suffers. Nobody is exempt, no matter their privilege. Therefore, you can allow or invite this quality of love seeing suffering, or compassion, the feeling with, or hurting with, you can allow that feeling, again, to become non-specific and spread through the body, through the universe. The third of the qualities is called mudita, and it's called sympathetic or appreciative joy. And it's what happens when this quality of love or metta, non-specific love, meets Someone who's doing well meets well-being or safety. Something's going well, and there's a natural upwelling of kind of reflected joy. Like, oh, you're doing so great, and I feel great because you're doing great. And this is one of the sweetest relational emotions in Buddhism, because it asks nothing of the other. It doesn't get anything. It's not like, you're doing great, could I hang out with you more? Right? That's not it. It's really just, you're doing great. How great that it makes me feel. That's awesome. Right? So that's that same and again, you know that everyone, some at various moments, feels okay or even really good. And certainly everyone, even the most oppressed, have the potential for feeling beautifully good, because we know that they are sentient beings. And so then, again, you can spread this quality to the ends of the universe. The fourth of the Brahmaviharas, or divine dwelling places, is a mysterious one. It's called equanimity, or upekkha, or upeksha in Sanskrit. And equanimity is a quality of the heart that remains balanced no matter what it's perceiving. Right? And even more rooted in wisdom, equanimity understands that there's suffering and there's joy, and they, in a certain way, the scales kind of balance if you take a big enough view, that they just keep changing. And there's an era of peace and then an era of war, and there's an era of plenty and an era of scarcity. And of course, it's the same on the large and tiny scales, right? So, you know, like, I have a moment of scarcity and my whole system contracts. And then, like, 5 minutes later, I could be having a moment of plenty and my whole system softens. And it just keeps doing that. Equanimity is still love. It's still a divine dwelling place of the heart, but it's love that... it's love that has let go even of the heating or warming quality of that first kind of metta, which can be quite juicy. It's let go even of that. It understands that states fluctuate. The big feeling of love comes and goes. As I've said many times, because my teacher said it many times, the heart opens and the heart closes, and it's actually natural for it to do so. Right? There's no requirement that we become like heart-open, shining people every minute of every day forever. Nor is it, appropriate to like put up our boundaries and go into deep self-care mode, receding from things, you know, forever. Like, no, but it opens and it closes and it actually does it on its own. So there's nothing particularly for you to do. You don't have to make it do one or the other, which is a relief, I think. So these qualities, these Brahmaviharas, because these are the quintessential heart qualities in the early Buddhist tradition, and they tend toward universalness, this becomes one strong way that the tradition also tends toward a kind of profound tolerance. It's not a tribal tradition. It's a tradition that really reached out to folks who were different. It reached out to folks of different languages and customs and religions even. It was not originally a religion. Certainly that word is much more ancient, much newer, sorry, than the tradition. But there's even some very interesting passages in the texts. There's one passage where the Buddha is telling some householders, that's us, what's the right thing to do, like how to respect your elders and take care of the kids and, you know, earn a living so that you can be generous to renunciates and people in need. And and he says some things about how the social order should run. And one of those is you should make the appropriate offerings to the sacrificial deities. That's actually him saying it's appropriate for the functioning of society to, you know, to participate in the religious culture of the time, to do what the Brahmins were doing, to sacrifice to Rudra, the storm god, and Ganga, the river, and Himalaya, the mountain, and Varuna, the waters. And then later on, those deities would become, you know, Durga and Shiva and Krishna. And that's a mysterious statement, because in other places it's clear that the Buddha is pushing back against those traditions and saying those rituals actually don't guarantee liberation. Those statements are not in opposition. He's saying it's part of social functioning to continue to do the rituals of society. And then he says, but you should know that they don't constitute, or they don't give rise to liberation from suffering, but they're part of the maintenance of things. But this partly means that Buddhism as a practice isn't in principle closed to other practices or religions. The Buddha instructed his monks and nuns to, once they were liberated, the first group of 500 monastics who were liberated, he said, now spread out, go to the ends of the earth, don't even go two together, go singly everywhere, and preach the Dhamma, these teachings, in the language of the people that you are with. So in ordinary language, for the benefit of beings. So that's one way that this practice at its heart is tolerant. Another, which is maybe subtler, is that renunciation, so letting go of material wealth and of really the desperate need for comforts that we carry, many of us most carry, letting go and orienting toward practice is a guideline not just for renunciate monastics, but for everyone. Lay people are instructed to make a lot of money so that you can give it all away. And the giving away is not a teaching anyone likes around here, anywhere, I think. But the teaching on giving says you should give like a pot of water that has been turned over, not a drop left. And that's a difficult teaching, right? And, you know, what does not a drop left mean? Because I have to balance that with non-harming. If I gave away everything in my, say, bank account and my house, it would bring harm to my child. Right? So clearly I can't do that. In other places, he says, lay people, you should be wealthy so that you can employ many people. This is a kind of feudal model. So you take care of your servants and your employees and the people who farm on your land and all that. That's the job of the wealthy, is to take care of people. Somebody should tell them that, because it's not happening the way one wishes. The job of governments and kings is to give away money. There's a text that says, there was a great king who found that there was a lot of crime in the land. And he decided to stop the crime by assembling the army and gathering up all those committing the crimes and execute them and put their bodies on display. And this made the people afraid, and poverty deepened, and the fields weren't sown, and the crime increased. Right? It straight up says punitive measures don't work. It says, but there was another king, a Dharma king, a wheel-turning king, who brings in money through wholesome means, and then to the merchants gives the funds necessary to support their businesses, and to the poor gives the funds necessary to live, and to everyone basically redistributes money, right? Taxation and redistribution. The wheel-turning king is a socialist. Just saying. But I didn't make that up. Buddhadasa said it first. Yeah. So there are these guidelines. Renunciation underpins all of them. Renunciation is the antidote to greed. Right? If the great poisons that constrict the heart are greed, hatred, and delusion, greed is the poison that arises from the wrong perception of scarcity. Right? We think that there's not enough, therefore we have to grasp. If there's absolutely enough, greed disappears. So renunciation, like not needing very much, is one of the only pathways on a world of limited resources to the feeling of sufficiency, that there is actually enough. There is enough if you don't need very much. If you need a lot, it's very difficult not to also have greed. Right? Greed doesn't mean like the sort of like the evil green monster that just wants and wants and wants. That's sort of the demonic form. But there's just that, they did a study where they asked people of, you know, all sorts of income ranges, you know, how much do you earn? Oh, I earn $20,000 a year. How much would you need to earn to be comfortable? Oh, I could do it on 30. 30 would be good. And they asked me, how much do you earn? Oh, I earn, you know, $750,000 a year. And well, are you comfortable? Well, no, I'd like to, it would really be good to earn, you know, like $900,000. You know, like, and they added up and they found that pretty much everyone basically said 30% more than what they earn would be, that would be right. That would be right on. No matter how high they got, the billionaires were like, my billions plus 30%, that's where I want to get to. So that's greed. Right? Again, it's not an evil, but it's a poison. Or as I've said a couple months ago, it's a kind of disease that lives in the culture. Right? We don't have a renunciate culture. We're not a culture that teaches simplicity. Right? Where are all the monks living on nothing? Oh, they disappeared. Right? The Catholic Church lost its monks. The renunciates, where are all the hippies living on nothing in communes? They went and got tech jobs. Like there's less renunciation visible in our culture than almost ever before. It's very hard to do, but you can do it. Right, hatred is hatred of the other. Hatred is linked inextricably to greed. If there's not enough, and I'm not getting enough, clearly you have some. Therefore, I can hate you for that. And all the other reasons, and it's deep. Why people learn to hate each other. So, love as a universal and renunciation as a practice unfold in this tradition as the possibility of a vast tolerance of others. If we begin to undo greed and hatred, other people, let's stick to people, but it's all beings. Other people are seen as suffering beings, like ourselves. There's much more similarity than there is difference. If we're practicing needing less, the war to get what the other one has fades. So, maybe the last thing I'll say is that in times of intense trauma or violence or hatred and greed in a culture, it's necessary for those of us who believe in goodness to stand up and act. We talk a lot about this in here. The Buddhist activist stance is a very particular one because it doesn't hold on to the idea of winning. It doesn't actually hold the idea that the system can be fixed permanently or completely. It acknowledges that everything changes and that our actions are part of that. So then, in a certain way, we must do what we can for well-being. Right? The precepts demand it. The intention to reduce suffering demands it. At the same time, we can learn to do that without holding the illusion of winning or of defeating the other. We actually see that to defeat the other defeats the purpose. Everyone loses if we defeat the other. So, this is not the comforting part of the teaching. But over and over in the texts, it is suggested that we are myopic when we think that just this lifetime is the one that matters. or that our particular moment in history is a pinnacle in some way. And again it says, this has been happening for a very, very long time, and the cycles turn and turn and turn. And during one cycle, we're a warrior for a certain kind of justice, and in another cycle, with other conditions, we're a profound renunciate receding into the space of the universal. And there's actually no rule that demands which one of those or where on that spectrum you are this time around. I think it's very right that some folks are fighting hard for certain things and other folks are deep in the caves, keeping the batteries of the heart charged in that way and preserving the teachings of deep renunciate solitude for future generations. It has to be done. The Buddha says if there's no one on the planet who knows how to attain samadhi or purify the heart, then the pathway to it is lost. Every single generation, somebody has to get enlightened, or else the path is lost, and it decays from there. And when it decays, it becomes empty words, shallow practices that don't work. So don't let that happen. All right, thanks for listening. Pleasure. Let's take a moment to just rest together in the middle of it all. Oh, some time for discussion, your voices, thoughts and feelings.
So the thing that kind of rises up for me with this, in this right now at this time,
yeah,
is like all of the kind of the violence that I'm hearing from a like normally compassionate left, you know, you're
yeah,
seeing violence and you're hearing that violence,
yeah,
the desire to do violence.
Yeah.
And like that's really like first of all it's really upsetting to me to hear that and to
yeah,
see like people that I respect, you know, kind of like joking about violence actually against others.
Yeah.
And so my initial response is always, you know, to kind of to say, you know, let's check ourselves here with these violent tendencies. And then there's another part that there's like a slower part of me that says there's a reason that this desire for violence is coming up
yeah,
on this side.
For sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. They're both true. Right. There is a reason, of course. And there's a practice of renunciation of that which is unwholesome. Renunciation of the unwholesome is not a universal practice. Not everyone has vowed to do it. And there are many folks whose vow is to protect beings, say, through whatever means necessary. And so who may have a lot of love and beautiful, wonderful people, of course. And still the impulse can arise that there's been so much violation, it must be met with force. And I respect that. You know, it's in a certain way, it's a privilege to be able to practice nonviolence. It's a privilege to be able to practice, period.
Yeah.
You know, and to not be in conditions that make inquiry and reflection even possible. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a practice one does near the beginning of one's practice where you remind yourself over and over of, it's essentially a gratitude practice. It's called the 18 reminders of the 18 qualities of the precious human life, the precious human birth. And you remind yourself that you haven't been born, you know, as a prey animal or as, you know, or in a war zone or in a time when there's no dharma or in a place where there's no teachers or in a place where you're starving. And there's this whole list. Basically, it says, if you're here in the room hearing this teaching, you automatically have all these things. And you enumerate them and you're grateful for them because you actually recognize that others don't have that. They might have a lot of other things, but they might not have a value that says that the vow of non-harming is beneficial. And in a certain way, like, I don't want to be the expert on that. Like, I don't know what's right for them. Clearly, everything exists and keeps happening, and in some very particular, you know, immediate ways, some of those people are defending our very freedoms to sit here and do this. So thank you to those people. It's a kind of self-sacrifice almost that they do it. And sometimes, yeah, that it leads to all sorts of places. Some of them have wonderful lives fighting for the cause. Some burn out, some don't. Some find practice and change their style. Some succeed and become powerful and do good. Like, I don't know. But I think it's for each of us to make the choice of how to practice. Yeah. And we've been lucky on the left recently. The left has not been lucky recently, but to have a left that has been mostly nonviolent for, you know, since, you know, certainly in a certain way since inspired by Gandhi and King, but at least in my lifetime, less and less overall violence. But certainly, you know, 100 years ago that wasn't the case, right? The left was just as militant as the right.
About self-love in Buddhism, and recently finding myself in a support role with someone who basically lost, you know, love of self, and how painful it was to witness, and to see how impossible everything felt without that. And I'm curious about practices of cultivating self-love, particularly when your surrounding environment this person is not from here, and in an American capitalist economy where it's sort of like your conditions are oftentimes telling you you're doing something wrong or you are wrong.
Absolutely.
By not succeeding, how does one combat that?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. You're going against the stream of the entire machine. The machine wants you to hate yourself. If you don't, you don't buy shit.
Exactly.
So that's what it wants of us, you know. And through no particular person's evil, really, it's just like, you know, the machine eats everything. So given that, I think of the practices that lead to self-love really essentially as trauma practices. No one hates themselves who hasn't been profoundly harmed. So that harm needs to be addressed. And in a certain way, traditional Buddhist practice doesn't even really include this aspect. It starts with healthy nervous systems. You know, the first practice is be generous, keep the precepts, and begin to see that everything changes. That's a very selfless beginning. And then from there it goes on into, you know, dissolve profoundly into the universe and recognize that you never existed at all in the way that you thought you did, which, you know, goes even further. So the self-love practices, I think really in a way, revolve around finding the feeling of safety somehow. Finding a set of people or a person or a place or a situation where vigilance and fear can soften and can be felt as feelings rather than simply be like on for self-protection. And once there's enough safety or security in the field, self-hatred is actually just it's a way to justify pain. It says, I hurt so much, you know, but there's not enough safety in the field to be able to feel and say, I hurt so much. So the only thing to do is to say, well, I'm a failure. So I hate myself, you know. It doesn't hurt as bad then, because you're the one wielding the weapon rather than just receiving the blow. So we need a place of enough safety to be able to actually feel the impact of what's happened to us and really warm and skillful and spacious support to really to fall out of that state through the layers of like grief and despair and then, you know, and hopelessness that all accompany it down into more manageable emotions. And that's a body of work, but it can be done for sure. And the supportive conditions are the best. So a good therapist, a good group, people, friends, you know, a lover, whatever works, a new family, something. Yeah, that's work for all of us to do. Other thoughts?
So when you were talking about, how do you pronounce it, metta?
Metta, yeah.
I realized that I've been in the opposite of that place for the past couple of days. And
you're not the only one.
Yeah.
Part of it has to do with what like many of us are feeling. And then also on a personal level, my mom came to town and we'd kind of avoided the political topic because we tend to differ, and I didn't realize how much we differed until this week when we were at a restaurant for my birthday, and there was a sign that said not our prez, and she felt really uncomfortable with the sign and vocalized it because she's on, you know, a different,
yeah,
thinking differently than that right now, and she was really offended by it and
yeah,
shocked, and she'd never seen something like that. And I was actually like, the first thing that came up, because we're in a public place, it's my birthday, I was like, my heart was like just jumping. And it feels like that even talking to, like, I almost feel like it's a confession. It's like, my mom supports trauma. But it's like, it's been so, I didn't know.
Most of us have them. No worries.
Yeah, I guess. I haven't talked to too many people that I know who are in this position, so.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that it's, a lot of people are dealing with this or, you know, trying to, I'm just trying to figure out how to approach it in a place that is wholesome and not, like, childish, and, but I find myself going back to, like, my teenage self of just, like, wanting to scream, and, like, I'm, in my head, I'm like, you're dumb, you know, and I don't like that I feel that, and then I feel guilty, and then I hate myself for thinking this about my own mother, and then I also feel uncomfortable that, like, she doesn't feel accepted where I live, and I know that she's a good person, and she's volunteered at Planned Parenthood, she wants the world to be, like, she supports, you know, all different types of people.
Yeah.
She's really supportive of, like, my...
And your practice is
excellent.
There's so much. And as you're saying it, right, your practice is, your practice of mindfulness is awake. That what you can actually do is you can list or track all of those mind states, right?
Yeah.
Right? She's a good person. She's wrong about this. I don't want to think that she's wrong. I love her. I hate her. I'm 12 and I want to scream. You're dumb. Like, each of those, right, is a feeling state that arises based in conditions and moves through. And nothing needs to be done about it, actually. Like, that's, it's just the process unfolding. So that's one level, is that you can actually do the practice of equanimity and observe not just her, but yourself. And you could say, oh, look, here's upset. My heart is racing. I don't know what to say. I'm da-da-da-da. And you can say, this is what this feels like. And it'll pass, right? And then you could say, oh, and I was talking to my mom. Oh, and I got so mad. It's like, oh, this is mad. Mad feels like this. And that passes. And I'm like, oh, I'm embarrassed. And then I'm confused. And each of them, all you do, right, is you stay with it, if you can. This is not an answer for what to do with your mom. Your best is what to do.
That was a dad answer.
Yeah, that was a dad. I am guilty as charged. Like we've been talking about a little bit with many of these practices, a value system and a practice to move one's own orientation in a certain direction is not a given in this world. Like, if you've chosen to practice, you know, tolerance and kindness and to be with your own feelings and process them, like, that's a choice you've made that you can't assume others have made, right? Because we're all part of different faiths, different traditions, different lineages, different conditions, and so she's made different choices, both in her conscious choice, which is a few things, and then vastly in the conditions that have given rise to her. She lives where she lives, she hears the news she hears, she's around the people she's around. It's in a certain way a natural process that she is expressing what she's expressing. So I think mostly from a practitioner point of view, our practice has to be tolerance. Beyond that, there's all of the sort of actual skills, like communication and deep listening and you know, empathy and getting out of our own position and seeing the play of the whole thing and deep education about the world and all of that that we can do. And you probably won't convince her to change.
Yeah, I think now I'm just working on what I've learned from this too is how to, it's more about like acceptance, and also because my reaction to it was like, well, we'll talk about this, I'm not going to be angry,
like I'll teach her in a way. It was not directly what I was thinking, but now that I look back, it was like she must not know all these things that are happening.
Right, right, good. So then your mindfulness keeps you awake to like, oh, I'll teach her the right way. Oh, I'm being patronizing. Like, you know, oh, I won't get angry, but I am angry, right? So, you know, I think it's okay to be transparent. I lean in the direction of transparency. To be like, here's how this feels, right? I'm upset and angry, I'm confused. I believe in these things. You know, this rhetoric feels hateful. Like, what? However you would say it. And, yeah. And you do the best you can. You know. And if you know, you take a few months break, that's fine too. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Anything else before we say goodnight? Right on. So it's a pleasure to be here with everyone. This group is offered, as always, in the profound and radical practice of gift economy. This is the basis of the entire path, is to give like a pot turned over. And in a very subtle way, to know what that means. What does that mean, to not hold anything back? It doesn't just mean empty your wallet. You can do that if you want, you're welcome to, but it's not what it means. But you can think about, in a deep way, as contemplatives, what it means, even as you sit in meditation in the morning with yourself. What would it mean to give like a pot turned over, nothing left behind? What would it mean when you're out at the Women's March, or you're writing your senator, or you're consoling someone who's weeping, or your friend just got a scary diagnosis, or there's ants in the dishes, to give with nothing left over? What would that mean? So then, the tiny gift of some money at the end of our practice is partly and very necessarily to support me in the studio in being able to offer it, and it's a practice unto itself. If you always give the same amount and it's become habitual, don't. At some point, don't give anything and see how that feels. At some point, give more and see how that feels. Find your way into the practice of giving as is actually a type of inquiry for yourself. So enjoy that as you like. We'll talk more about it later on. Donations go in the little basket by the candle. I brought for our little puja tonight the Buddha, a little bit of water, a little bit of earth, and the candles are fake because we've had enough fire this year. I won't be here next week. Ashley Sharp, most likely, will be here. She's a wonderful teacher. Please come, and I'll be back the following week. Take good care.